This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll hear Terry's interview with Dustin Hoffman. But first, Ben Affleck. Last Sunday, Affleck won a Golden Globe for directing the film Argo, and Argo won for Best Motion Picture Drama. Affleck also is one of Argo's producers, as well as its star. Terry's interview with Ben Affleck was recorded on January 8th, 5 days before the Golden Globes. Argo is based on a true story. The film begins in 1979 at the start of the Iranian Revolution, when an angry mob storms the American embassy in Tehran, taking the diplomats hostage. Six Americans escape and eventually find refuge, hiding out in the home of the Canadian ambassador. Affleck plays CIA agent Tony Mendez, who comes up with a scheme to get those six Americans home. His idea is to have them pose as a Canadian film crew, scouting locations in Iran for a science fiction film called Argo. Mendez flies to Tehran with fake papers and Canadian passports for the six, and cover stories that will enable them to pass themselves off as members of a Canadian film crew. In this scene, Mendez is in Tehran at the Canadian ambassador's home, quizzing the six on the cover stories he's given them to make sure they've committed the stories to memory and can convincingly repeat them under pressure.
Where is your passport issued?
Vancouver.
Where were you born?
Toronto.
Toronto. Canadians don't pronounce the T.
Some comité guard is actually going to know that.
If you're detained for questioning, they will bring in someone who knows that. Yes.
Mary, who are the last three prime ministers of Canada?
Trudeau, Pearson, and Diefenbaker.
What's your father's name?
Howard.
What's his occupation?
Fisherman.
Where were you born?
Halifax, Nova Scotia.
What's your date of birth?
February 21st, 1952.
Good. What's your job on the movie?
Producer.
Associate producer. What was the last movie you produced?
High and Dry.
Who paid for that?
CFDC.
What's your middle name? What's your middle name? What's your middle name?
Leon?
Shoot him. He's an American spy. Look, they're going to try to break you, okay? By trying to get you agitated. You have to know your resume back to front.
You really believe your little story is going to make a difference when there's a gun to our heads?
I think my story is the only thing between you and a gun to your head.
Ben Affleck, welcome to Fresh Air. I have to tell you, I always get scared when I hear that scene because, you know, I put myself in the shoes of the house guests, the hostages staying at the Canadian embassy homes. And I have such a bad memory. So I know, like, if you were grilling me and I was in that situation, I'd go, my birthday, oh, my God, I forgot what my birthday is. Oh, I forgot the Canadian prime minister's name. And you'd be going, shoot her.
You'd get killed, yeah. The irony of that scene is that was one where I said to them when I actually had all those house guests live on that set for a week together before we started shooting to create a bond and for them to sort of understand what it was like to be holed up together with somebody. And I said, if any of you feel like you can create a biography and give it to me, we'll use it in some of the scenes at some point. And the only person to do it, actually, which surprised me, was Clea Duvall. So she's the one who ended up getting the little sort of getting interrogated moment. And I thought, well, I'm going to hit her with, you know, in the middle of this take with her answers that she wrote down. And she was pretty good. She had them memorized and prepared. And then we said cut. And all the other actors were like, oh, I didn't know it was going to be in the movie. I would have prepared something.
I didn't know that was going to be on the test.
Exactly.
So you were, about eight when the hostage crisis actually happened?
Yeah, that's right. I was 8 years old.
So were you watching the news then? Do you have memories of it from that time?
You know, the earliest memory I have of sort of world events is President Reagan's assassination attempt, which was 1982. So I really hadn't fully figured out that there was a big, broader world out there. I don't even remember the yellow ribbons particularly. I was just, for whatever reason, kind of hadn't gotten there yet. And so this was the sort of like history in the same way doing a movie about the Revolutionary War would have been history for me. I had to start from scratch.
So when you went back to look at news footage, and I should say that you really tried to, and I think succeeded in capturing images for your film that looked, you know, like some of the iconic moments of that time. And at the end of the film, you even juxtapose news footage, like news stills, with shots from your movie. But were those scenes all basically new to you?
Yeah, they were new to me, except that I kind of – Chris Terrio, who's the writer, wrote this incredible screenplay, and he started me off with, here's the research that I've done. Take a look at this. And it really blew my mind because, you know, it included the – like the footage of the guy who says, you know, he's mad as hell and he references Network. You know, some specific things like that that were just so rich. And then from there, I kind of dove into it. And I got so interested in the research and so kind of obsessed with it that I started handing it out to the various department heads and saying, this is exactly what I want. This is what I want it to look like. This is how I want it to feel. And I was so proud of their work and so impressed by it and wanted to showcase it that I maybe in a touch of like self-aggrandizement, you know, or at least collective self-aggrandizement, put it up at the end for people to see. And also because I wanted them to see, yeah, this is actually what it was really like. This takeover of the hostage of the U.S. Embassy really happened, and this is how it happened. And because there was a part of me that was amazed by that as well.
And you have a little history lesson at the beginning, which I was glad you did because – a lot of people like you were too young to remember what happened or weren't even born yet. And so without some kind of historical context, you don't really know what the real story is about.
Yeah, I was a Middle Eastern studies major, so I had taken a couple, mostly focused on the Arab world, but I had taken a couple of classes about Iran and the Islamic Revolution there. And so jumping into this movie, I already had a context for, you know, why this was happening. And all of a sudden it occurred to me that I was going to start a movie off where audiences were just going to think these are bearded sort of meanies who arbitrarily just don't like the United States and are frothing at the mouth to tear down the bricks of our embassy. And that really, really neglected decades of and even almost century of interplay between our nations and between the West and Iran that led to this moment. Even more than that, I thought it robbed the audience of an understanding of the way in which this was really quite relevant. For example, you know, we deposed this guy Mossadegh, who was an elected secular leader. We installed the Shah because he would sort of be our friend, sell us oil, and because he had the patina of being Western, you know, and he sort of said the right things, and we turned a blind eye to his corruption and to his cronyism and to his oppression, which I thought was very much like what happened with Mubarak. And then both situations, you know, ultimately ended up in revolutions, and both those revolutions produced results that were unpredictable and that were tricky for us to try to navigate or even understand. So I wanted that historical context in the beginning so that the audience could kind of get where this all came from.
So one of the things you had to do in the movie was recreate the takeover of the American embassy in Tehran and have like mobs of angry Iranians chanting what I assume is death to America in Farsi?
Yeah, there were two or three chants. The main chant was Magbar Amrika, which is death to America, yeah.
So you shot on location in Turkey. How do you cast all the extras to be chanting death to America?
Well, that was quite a difficult thing, as it turned out. I was really convinced that we didn't want to use digital extras, that would take away the potency.
Boy, that hadn't even occurred to me.
Yeah, that's what people do now. You go see movies about, you know, in baseball stadiums, and they're all digital people created by visual effects artists. And that's great, and those artists are really talented. But something about dragons and fire and that stuff lends itself to visual effects in a way that people don't. You know, digital effects extras tend to do, you know, they put their arm up, their arm down, their head to the left and then to the right, and then they repeat those motions. They're sort of repetitive. They're not complex at all. And to me, what that does is it takes away the potency of the power of a crowd and how that can be really scary. And so I wanted to use real people, made a big thing out of it. We wanted over 2,000 people for the takeover, which was hardly, you know, it would have been a light day for David Lean. But for me, it was a big deal. And the problem was it was really a students' revolution, but all the students were in school. And I thought we could put a little money out there and get a lot of Turks. It turns out their growth rate is like 6 to 8%. I mean, they're just – things are booming in Turkey. So we couldn't get any students. The professional folks are naturally working and making more money than we were offering them. So the only people that were available to us were folks over 65. So we turned it into a bit of a seniors' revolution.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
It hadn't occurred to me watching it that, oh, yeah, it should be students.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm glad.
I want to play another scene from the movie. And this is a scene in which you playing the CIA agent who comes up with the cover story to smuggle out or exfiltrate, as the word is, the Americans who are in hiding at Canadian embassy houses. So you're talking with the makeup artist. You're telling him you need his help for the cover story, and you're talking about how to disguise the Americans as a film crew. So he's looking through the dossiers of the Americans, trying to figure out what role they should play in this fake story that you're cooking up.
Exactly, what covers they should have. Yeah.
Well, this one's got an MA in English. She should be your screenwriter. Sometimes they go along on scouts because they want the free meals. Here's your director.
You teach somebody to be a director in a day?
You teach a rhesus monkey to be a director in a day. Look, if you're going to do this, you got to do it. The Comaniacs are Fruit Loops, but they got cousins who sell prayer rugs and 8-tracks on La Brea. You can't build cover stories around a movie that doesn't exist. You need a script. You need a producer.
Make me a producer.
No, you're an associate producer at best. You're going to do a $20 million Star Wars ripoff. You need somebody who's a somebody to put their name on it. Somebody respectable. With credits. Who you can trust with classified information. Who'll produce a fake movie. For free.
It's a funny scene. So the little joke John Goodman makes in there about how you can teach a rhesus monkey to direct in a day.
Yeah.
Having directed your third film now, what do you think of that joke?
I think maybe
is
not
that a joke
day,
that's commonly
but,
made in Hollywood?
No, I think what it's about and why I like the joke is that it's sort of got two. One aspect is, yes, there I am. I'm the director. He's saying it to me. It has that kind of cuteness to it. But really, it speaks to something that people don't often think about Hollywood, which is the kind of class hierarchy, that there's this above the line, this narrow strip of people, director, stars, sort of prima donna, that kind of thing. And then the huge – there's sort of the icing, right? And then the huge bulk of the cake, who are all the workaday people, the lunch pail folks who do that job. And I wanted to liken them to the folks at the CIA who sort of do a similar job, and that he's expressing a cynicism about the kind of vain, you know, sort of maybe fools that he has to work with periodically. The guy who's, you know, basically kvetching about his boss.
So we talked a little bit about having to, you know, kind of compress events and leave things out because it's a movie and
Absolutely. You
have 2 hours, and this is a story that took a long time to actually play out. And a question I always wonder about when I see a historical film is, like, what actually happened and what's been fictionalized for the purposes of storytelling in the movie. So watching your movie, of course, I thought about that too.
Sure, of course.
And there are some things that are, you know, are pretty different in the film compared to the reality. And like one example is, you know, there's a very thriller aspect of it toward the end. Without giving anything away, there's always something happening that's threatening them every step of the way so that they're going to be discovered. And I think most of those things didn't happen with that kind of timing, or
right.
maybe didn't happen at all
right.
In reality, which isn't to say reality wasn't
really
terrifying and dramatic, but these like split second escapes and nearly getting discovered and so on didn't happen that way.
Right. Well, you know, I always feel like that's what they pay me for as a director, you know, is to if you accept the fact, and I do, that the escape for them was extremely harrowing. And scary, you know, and it was mostly about getting from where they were to the airport, getting through these checkpoints and getting on this airplane, that was the story of it. So what I did with the end, in order to have a third act that I felt sort of worked, that wasn't just a bunch of people like walking through checkpoints and looking at their paperwork, was to add elements to that and to cross-cut it in ways that, you know, used what I bring to it, what I had, to try to make it more exciting and to make it more tense. You know, as you point out, it's tricky because you can't flash up subtitles that say, okay, hold on, this part right here when the guard looked over at them, that didn't happen. Or those cars were not on the runway, but they did in fact take off. Also, there's a sort of uncertainty because we don't really know from the Iranian side, you know, where everybody was, when they found out, what they did. We just know that they went there, went through the checkpoints and got on the plane. And at some point between that and when the next morning, when the Iranian minister went on television saying that Canada would pay, they found out. And it's that that struggle between, as I said, the bookkeeper's reality and the reality, the poet's reality. And you make judgments as a director. And my judgment falls really cleanly on the line of it's okay to embellish, it's okay to compress, as long as you don't fundamentally change the nature of the story and of what happened.
During the closed credits, the actual President Jimmy Carter speaks. And what he says during the closed credits is, you know, this operation was kept secret until it was declassified by President Clinton in 97. So, you know, no one knew about the story outside of the CIA until then. And so President Carter says at the end of your film that it was a great temptation to reveal this history so that maybe he could take a little credit for it. And he says, eventually we got every...
Further evidence that Hollywood is just like politics.
He says, eventually we got every hostage home safe and sound, and we upheld the integrity of our country and did it peacefully. Did you feel for him when he said, like, because he's being funny when he says it, but you know he means it too? Because he got such... I mean, he lost the election over it, and he lost his reputation in a lot of ways over the Iranian hostage crisis because he was seen as weak. But he did get the people home, and he did prevent us from going to war.
Yeah, and it's funny that we tend to perceive that as weak. It took a long time. There wasn't a lot of patience. As you point out, there's no question, if you ask him or virtually anybody else, that he lost the election in large measure because of that hostage crisis. And he didn't get them, but they weren't released until Reagan's inauguration day. Khomeini had come to hate Carter so much that he kind of wanted to punish him. You know, the thing – I didn't want to make it a referendum on the Carter presidency because it's a different thing. What I liked actually speaks exactly to what we were just talking about, which is if you go with the audience and they go all the way through this movie and you get to the end of the movie and the guy who was president of the United States during that time says, yes, this in fact happened. The CIA went in as a movie company and got these people out and no one could know about it. To me, that gives you a, all right, that's basically the story. We know that's true. We grant that, you know, maybe the cars went a little faster or somebody said, you know, a joke that they didn't say or that kind of about rhesus monkeys or whatever. But the essence of this story is really true. And here's Jimmy Carter saying it, and here it cost him his presidency. And what that means is that the country went in a completely different direction. And when he says, I wish I could have taken credit for these six people getting out, I think what's underneath that is maybe I wouldn't have lost the election. Maybe I would have looked like I could do something successful. Maybe, you know, this would have been good for me. I don't like necessarily feel bad or feel good for him, but I do think that he makes a really valid point about this, and it does raise the profile of this incident of six people to something that you think, you know, this might have, were it not secret in the way that it was for the United States, it might have changed the course of American electoral politics.
This is the third feature film you've directed. Before that, The Town, and your first directorial feature, Gone Baby Gone. I love that film.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And so what was it like the first time out as a director, directing without any experience? And, you know, it turned out good.
Thank you. I was very, very scared. You know, I just didn't know if I could do it. The only thing I can think of, a good metaphor, is running a marathon where you just don't know, am I even going to finish? You know, maybe I'll just fall over at mile 15 or something. Or, you know, it seems so daunting and so far. And, yeah, I had been prepared in the sense that I had directed shorts. I'd always wanted to be a director. I'd been on a lot of sets. But that just felt like very little compared to the task of directing a movie when I went into it. And every day I was scared, and I probably stayed that scared throughout. And when I looked at the first assembly, I thought it was terrible. And so I just started, you know, dove in and started working on it and worked on it until I didn't.
So you re-edited the whole thing?
Yeah. I mean, I actually changed editors in the middle and hired another editor, but he couldn't come on for a couple of months. Incidentally, it's William Goldenberg, who did both our movie and Zero Dark Thirty this year. So he's the CIA real story specialist. So in that interim, I was by myself cutting the movie. And my wife was in a movie in Arizona, and so I was just in this room in our house in Arizona cutting away. But, you know, I guess the short answer is I was really, really scared and not sure of myself at all.
Were there things you felt you had to fake at first until you had done it enough to know for real? Because I think it's that way in most positions, that you have to just kind of fake your way through initially?
Yeah, I talked to the one advantage I had is I could talk to other people who had done it. And I remember talking to Kevin Costner and saying, like, what do I do? I'm going to direct a movie. And Kevin said, make sure that on your first day you know what your second shot is. I was like, what do you mean? He said, everyone goes in there and knows what their first shot is. And I do the first shot and all of a sudden think, what am I going to do now? He's like, make sure you know the second shot and that'll get you rolling into, you know, we're going to do this. We finished that. Okay, guys, let's go over here. And now the crew trusts you.
Was that a good advice?
It was definitely good advice. I had great advice from a lot of those different guys, mostly centered around, I thought this was interesting, not trying to be noble about anything. In other words, if you need more takes on yourself, do more takes, because if you don't, you're going to end up in the editing room without enough material.
But you mean by being noble, like if your performance needed another take, but the other actor in the scene did good, don't feel guilty about asking for another take?
Noble in terms of don't – in other words, you do takes. I'm going to do a close-up on you and a close-up on me.
Yeah.
So say we do a close-up on you and we do 9 takes. He's saying don't be noble by just turning around on yourself and doing one take and going, oh, I think we're fine. Don't worry. We're not going to wait on me, that sort of thing.
Right.
Be willing to allow people to wait on you as well as you would if it were just another, you know, actor.
How do you direct yourself? What do you tell yourself? Like when you have a director, they can say, well, we need another take or give me more or give me less or...
There's a couple of things. One, there's a monitor so you can go over and kind of watch it. And eventually you just have to get rid of this. You have to slough off this kind of insecurity about looking at yourself. You know how you hate to hear your own voice on an answering machine. You must be over that because you do it all
really.
Day. But, but the other thing is, you know, you get to... I just shoot a lot of film, and as I go through it, I try different choices. I'll be a little more afraid here, a little more angry, a little faster, a little slower, that sort of thing. And I'll do 10, 11, 12 takes, and then I really do the direction of myself in the editing room. So I can, you know, go throw this out, throw that out, throw this out, and then get down to the few things that I think have merit and calibrate those there. And I don't pretend that I'm going to have the sort of perspective on the day that I'll have later. And so I just try to throw enough stuff in the bag that, you know, I'll have something left when it comes time to look at it all.
You started acting when you were 8?
I did, when I was 8 years old, yeah.
So was that helpful? Like, is there anything you learned then that you still use now?
You know, what I learned then that's helpful was to sort of be the sense of comfort being in front of a camera. And maybe some sort of early adultification that was helpful. What wasn't helpful was that there was no premium placed on the emotional truth of acting. It was kind of like, you know, it was like getting through the day. You know what I mean? You say the words, you look the right way, you sort of move on. And so that early on, I took that on as my idea of what acting was and then really had to relearn it when it occurred to me that, you know, it should be interesting to watch.
When did that occur to you?
In high school, I had a great acting teacher named Jerry Specka, who, you know, me and Matt and my brother and all these – and a lot of other really good actors who are working now still went through his classes. And you know, he taught that it had to be – he didn't just say the words. It had to be good. It had to have an emotional reality to it.
So when you were a kid, you auditioned for the Mickey Mouse Club and for Batman and Robin, didn't get the part. And Matt Damon was auditioning with you for that.
Yes, don't leave Matt out.
Did that hurt your self-esteem? I mean, I think one of the really hard parts of acting for any actor is you get rejected so much of the time until you finally establish yourself, if you ever establish yourself. And a lot of actors don't ever even reach that point. So it's just, you know, a career of rejection.
Yeah, no, it's true.
What was it like to handle that as a kid? And we're not talking about a school play. I mean, Right. We're talking about TV shows.
Well, I didn't do very much. I mean, I did, you know, came out of Voyage of the Mimi, and then I did this after school special with Madeline Kahn, and then I did a TV movie with Forrest Whitaker and Blair Brown and Beverly D'Angelo and Armand Asante, and then I started sort of auditioning, kind of going to New York. Matt and I would go down and audition. And at first, I would say for the first half of the bell curve as an actor, that rejection is good for you. It coarsens you to, you know, getting turned down, because you're going to get turned down a lot and you have to just sort of keep rolling and keep believing that you can do this despite the fact that the last 30 people you read for didn't want to hire you, and recognize that those are kind of your odds. Eventually, you need to get some work. Otherwise, you come down the backside of the bell curve, and exactly what you describe happens, which is, I mean, people start to get a very defeatist attitude. They get very depressed. They get sad, and then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. My goal from going up and auditioning in high school to moving out to L.A. after high school and auditioning to when I first really started getting work when I was 24, 25 was I just want to work enough so that I could say that I was an actor, not a actor waiter, that I could just with pride look myself in the mirror and say, this is actually what I do for a living.
How did auditioning as a child affect you as a director auditioning people today?
Enormously. I hate directing young actors. I hate auditioning them, rather. I don't even like having them in the movie. I like to get them in and out. I would never in a million years allow my children to be actors.
As children.
As children, yes. I would never allow them as adults, although I think I'll have very little control over that. And I think I find it difficult because I had some, complicated experiences as a young person. When I look back on that, some of it was really valuable and some of it I think was not. And I just see kids, oftentimes getting pushed out there and forced to do stuff. And maybe I'm over, reading something into it because I know a lot of, Blake Lively was, I think, a young, kid actress. She turned out great. She's
you
great.
You turned out okay.
I did, but it's a tricky thing. I think it says something that I wouldn't let my kids be actors, put it that way.
Right, right. So before you go, I just have to ask you, did on Saturday Night Live a really funny impression of Keith Olbermann a few years ago when Olbermann still had a show on MSNBC. And I played it for Olbermann when he was on. So I have to ask you, was that an impression you had already worked up and that you told SNL about and said, hey, I can do this on the show? Or did...
They came to me when I got on SNL and said, we have this Olbermann thing that we've been wanting to do. We think you could do it. Are you up for it? And so I looked at – they hadn't had the full material, but I said, yeah, definitely. Let me work on him. Let me watch a bunch of his stuff and try to go after it a little bit. And then the material started getting better, and I started getting finding more things to do with the impersonation. But it was fun. It was a really good time, and I actually saw him. He came down. His office was in the building. He came down during one of the rehearsals, and so I saw him briefly, and I think he got the joke. Having been, having been the subject of that kind of thing many times myself, I feel like you got to have a sense of humor about it,
Have you always done impressions? I mean, is that part of?
I like to do impressions. Yeah, I do. I feel a little bashful of it because I know it's not really acting. Like once you get into mimicry and impressions, it is a gift and a gift that I love to watch. The guy on SNL who can do Denzel to me is just amazing. But I try not to rely too much on it because I know that it's sort of like – I used to play chess a lot with my brother and Matt, and we all lived together. And then we got into speed chess. And all the teachers would say, you can't play speed chess. It'll ruin your game. And I think there's something about impressions a little bit that will ruin your game because it's just the fast Chinese food accessible version of a character.
Nevertheless, who do you do?
I used to do Denzel. I used to do Morgan Freeman. I used to do Al Pacino, a whole bunch of them. Olbermann's like a face thing, and a little bit of, he kind of likes to have himself be sort of down here. He has that kind of I'm a serious newsman kind of thing. And Denzel's like, it doesn't matter if I'm going to insult me or not. It doesn't matter if I'm in this case or not. I'm going to find out the truth. I guarantee you that. God damn it, Denzel. That's Morgan. What'd I tell you? Mm-hmm. Come down here. Well, and talk about folks coming around here. He's got that kind of whatever he says, it says down here. You don't need to understand. That's Morgan. And
that's
Al
great.
Is like, hello, Al Pacino. What do you know? Welcome. This is a fresh air. You know what we're talking about. I want to see his Glengarry. I hear it's really good. I'm excited.
Ben Affleck speaking with Terry Gross. You'll find a longer version of their conversation, which was recorded before Affleck won 2 Golden Globes last Sunday, online at freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Last month, Dustin Hoffman received one of America's highest accolades for artists, a Kennedy Center honor. And this month marks his directorial debut with the release of his film Quartet. Earlier this week, Terry spoke with Dustin Hoffman about Quartet and about his long career as an actor. You'll find that entire interview on our website, but let's hear an excerpt of that conversation now. During the Kennedy Center Honors, Dustin Hoffman's good friend Robert De Niro paid tribute to him, saying, quote, "Stardom was never his destination. It's what he did with it that changed us and what we call a leading man," unquote. Hoffman's breakthrough role came in 1967's The Graduate. He played Benjamin Braddock, a recent college grad who becomes involved in an affair with Mrs. Robinson, the wife of his father's business partner. The Graduate was directed by Mike Nichols.
Did Mike Nichols have you? I know he saw you in a play and was pretty confident he wanted you for The Graduate, but did he have you do an audition?
Yes, he wasn't confident that he wanted me. He auditioned me. I was with Catherine Ross. I think he had been looking for at least a year and a half, and we were at the end of the list. I really do believe that we had been in the first week of people he was screen testing, we wouldn't have gotten it. I was told later that Larry Terman, the producer, when they looked at the test, which went very badly, they turned to each other, and Larry says, "Well, you know, that's it. There's nobody else I can think of that we can test. You know, either we go with them or we don't do it." And I think it was a resigned feeling that they go with us. And if I may say, I didn't change or alter the image of what a leading actor should look like. It was Mike Nichols. That part was written from a book by Charles Webb called The Graduate. The character Benjamin Braddock was identified in the book as being about 6 feet tall, blonde hair, blue-eyed, I mean, interchangeable with Robert Redford, if you will, who also tested. And it was Mike who went against casting. And I must say that when the film was finished, I went back to New York to go back on unemployment while they were cutting the film. And when they finished cutting the film, they showed it to people who had screening rooms in their homes, Beverly Hills. And they said later, both Terman and Nichols in interviews, that people came up to them and said, "What a great film you would have had if you had not miscast the lead." And that was the feeling even after it was finished.
So let me just introduce a scene from the film. The Graduate is about, you know, you've graduated college, you've come back, you're living with your parents in their suburban home, you don't have a job, you don't know what your future looks like, and you've started having an affair with the unhappy suburban woman. She is also the mother of the woman you end up marrying at the end of the movie. So you're having this affair with her that's really just all about sex, and it's kind of driven in a large way by her boredom and your young sexual appetite. So you're in bed, and you get out of bed after having sex, you turn on the light, and you basically think, maybe it's time to actually say something to each other. So here's that scene.
"Look, for months, all we've done is come up here and leap into bed together."
"Are you tired of it?"
"I'm not, no. But do you think we could liven it up with a little conversation for a change?"
"Well, what do you want to talk about?"
Anything at all."
"Do you want to tell me about some of your college experiences?"
"Oh, my God. Think of another topic."
"How about art?"
"Art? That's a good subject. You start it off."
"You start it off. I don't know anything about it."
"Well, what do you want to know about it? Are you interested more in modern art or in classical art?"
"Neither."
"You're not interested in art?"
"No."
"Then why do you want to talk about it?"
"I don't."
"Now, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation. Tell me what you did today."
"I got up."
"Oh."
"I fixed breakfast for my husband."
"There. There's something we could have a conversation about. Your husband."
"Oh, him."
"I mean everything. I don't know anything about how you work this. What do you say to him when you leave the house at night?"
"Nothing. He's asleep."
"Always? Doesn't he wake up when you come home?"
"We have separate bedrooms."
"Oh, I see. So you don't... I mean, I don't like to seem like I'm prying, but I guess you don't sleep together or anything."
"No, we don't."
"Well, how long has this been going on?"
"For God's sake, let's
drop
this."
"Wait a minute. Why did you marry him?"
"See if you can guess."
"Well, I can't."
"Think real hard, Benjamin."
"I can't see why you did, unless... You didn't have to marry him or anything, did you?"
That's Dustin Hoffman and Anne Bancroft in a scene from The Graduate. So was it awkward for you, your first time in a movie, to be in bed with Anne Bancroft, who's already a star because of her role in The Miracle Worker?
No, it was the hardest part was to be in bed with playing a lead that was supposed to be handsome. Just getting the part. When he first called me and asked me to test, I read it and I said to him, I don't want to test. I don't think I'm right for it. I feel awkward trying to pretend that I'm anywhere near someone looking like Robert Redford. And he convinced me. And so, you know, I went into it reluctant from the beginning. And I think he felt a reluctance as we were shooting. You know, have I made a mistake? It was a huge piece of miscasting. Working with Anne Bancroft was one of the great parts of the experience because she is a great actor. Ironically, she lived on the same street as I did with Mel Brooks, and he was my idol.
I had read that you actually turned down a part in The Producers in order to do The Graduate. Is that true?
Yes. Mel Brooks gave me what I thought was going to be the start to my career because he'd seen me off Broadway, offered me a part in The Producers. I said yes 1,000 times yes, and then I get The Graduate, and I had to call him and say, I can't do it. I got this other part. And being in bed with Anne Bancroft, it's just working, it's just making movies, was not difficult.
It's Mel Brooks' wife, Anne Bancroft.
Yes, and it was more difficult for him because Anne told me that he used to call up every other day because he was in New York and we were in L.A. and he would always start the conversation off with, did he kiss you yet? He was a little jealous.
So that's how you thanked him for offering you a role, turning it down and going to bed with his wife.
Yes.
So Kramer versus Kramer, one of your big movies, you won an Oscar for it. You know, you're married to Meryl Streep in the beginning, and you're so obsessed with your job in an advertising agency that you're really hardly paying attention to her or your son. And she tells you that she's breaking up with you, and you don't even hear her at first. And when she walks out the door, you kind of notice what's going on, and you think she's going to come back, but she doesn't. And so you're in the position of being the single parent with your son, and you have to reshape your whole life. And it's a long series of discoveries about your son and parenthood and the meaning of work in your life and so on. So let me just play a brief scene here. And this is the famous French toast scene where it's the first morning after your wife has left and you're making French toast for your son and you have no idea how to make it. And he's kind of directing you.
Now, where's mommy keep the...
In the stove.
Okay. First thing we need is a nice hot fire. No, you're not doing it right. Come here. You're not doing it right. Look, you gotta do it fast. See? The rest is the rest. So the gucky part gets dissolved. Then you take the bread and we fold it. That's what we do. We fold the French toast.
I think you forgot the milk.
I didn't. Milk comes last. You always got to put the milk in last. When you're having a good time, you forget the most important thing, right? I just want to see if you were paying attention. It's been a long time since I made this. That's fun, isn't it? When's the last time Mommy let you in the kitchen?
I don't like it when it's in pieces.
Look, the French toast tastes the same whether it's in pieces or whether it's whole. I mean, bread is bread, you know? Besides, what you don't know is that French toast is always folded. You go into the best restaurants anywhere in the world, and you see folded French toast. You get more bites that way, right? And while that's going, Daddy's going to make a little bit of coffee for himself. You having a good time? Are you? All right, we're having a great time. I don't remember the last time I ever had such a good time. Daddy's going to make himself a little coffee.
It's too much coffee.
No. I like it strong. And Mommy always makes it too weak.
Can I have some orange juice?
Orange juice, right. Right, one of OJ coming up. What a kid.
Daddy, it's burning. It's burning.
What?
It's burning.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, damn it. Oh, God damn her.
That's Dustin Hoffman in a scene from Kramer versus Kramer. You were already divorced or separated from your first wife when you made the film. You had a child. Were you relating to the character when you made it?
You know, I was actually separated, you know, which led in the kind of in the midst of getting a divorce. And my first wife had brought a child into the marriage, and we had biologically our own kid. So, yes, we had two kids. And I was aware that this was the first time I was ever making a film or doing any kind of an acting job of what I was going through in life I was going to work to pretend to be doing. And people said to me at that time, you know, is it painful? Is it difficult? And I said, no, it's actually quite liberating. And I was aware then that, you know, actors aren't really creators. We're recreators of what someone else has written. And this was the first time I could feel like a creator. And the director, Bob Benton, who also wrote it, allowed me to alter things based on what I was feeling on the day. There was a great deal of improvisation. And on that scene, there was also... I might add that Justin Henry, who was so wonderful in it, first started...
He played your son, yeah.
Yes. He first started coming to work. I think he had been kind of directed, quote-unquote, by his parents the day before, days before. So he kind of was set in the way he would say things. And it wasn't like he was in life. And I said, Justin, you don't talk like that when we talk together. Why are you acting like, quote, a kid out of some TV sitcom or something? I said, just, you know, be yourself. And Benton and I agreed that we would not tell his parents what scene we were shooting. We would literally find it that particular day, and we would improvise it and then narrow it down in terms of what choices we would use for the takes. But his performance, as was mine, was basically improvised, so that he didn't try to do a kid. He played himself. And we did have an emotional bond between each other, which I, you know, you really can't act that that's either exists or it doesn't.
You know, we've talked a lot about acting. You taught acting when you were in your 20s, before you were even in a movie. When you look back at what you taught when you were in your 20s, would you stand by any of that?
Yeah, because I wasn't teaching movie acting. I was teaching acting as best as I could, and it was after a few years of studying with Strasberg. So I felt I understood how to teach it. In Tootsie, there's a scene where I am teaching actors, and I improvised that scene. And basically, that was a real classroom of actors that my friend Jack Walzer, who was a teacher, I called him up the day before. I said, send over your class tomorrow morning at 6:30. I finally have been allowed to shoot this scene. And those are real actors, and I'm just doing what I did on the days I taught acting, and it's right there. Basically, it's... don't follow the derivative. Unfortunately, it's the derivative that usually gets hired. When you have an original feeling, it's usually because you yourself are a unique person. So your questions are your questions about the character. Just as you, Miss Gross, your questions, I would bet, are your questions and not someone else telling you to ask these questions.
True.
And that's what I started with.
So you mentioned Tootsie. There's that famous scene in Tootsie where Sidney Pollack, the director of the film, is playing your agent. And you go in and you're complaining that you're not getting parts and that you sent him your roommate's play and you want to be in that play. And Sidney Pollack, your agent, hasn't done anything with it. And you're angry with him. I want to just play that scene.
Look, I don't want to argue about it, okay? I'm going to raise the $8,000 myself so I can produce his play, and I want you to send me up for anything. I don't care what it is. I will do dog commercials on television. I will do radio voiceovers.
Michael, I can't put you up for any of that.
Why not?
Because no one will hire you.
Oh, that's not true, man. I bust my ass to get a part right, and you know I do.
Yes, and you bust everybody else's ass, too. That's what you do. A guy's got 4 weeks to put on a play. You think he wants to sit and argue about whether or not Tolstoy can walk when he's dying or walk when he's talking or sing when he's walking?
That was 2 years ago, and that guy is an idiot.
They can't all be idiots, Michael. You argue with everybody. You've got one of the worst reputations in this town, Michael. Nobody will hire you.
Are you saying that nobody in New York will work with me?
Oh, no, that's too limiting. Nobody in Hollywood wants to work with you either. I can't even send you up for a commercial. You played a tomato for 30 seconds. They want a half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato! A tomato doesn't have logic! A tomato can't move!
That's what I said! So if he can't move, how's he gonna sit down, George? I was a stand-up tomato, a juicy, sexy beefsteak tomato! Nobody does vegetables like me! I did an evening of vegetables off Broadway! I did the best tomato, the best cucumber! I did an endive salad that knocked the critics on their ass!
Michael,
I'm trying to stay calm here. You are a wonderful actor.
Thank you.
But you're too much trouble. Get some therapy.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to raise $8,000, and I'm going to do Jeff's play.
Michael, you're not going to raise 25 cents. No one will hire you.
Oh, yeah?
That's Dustin Hoffman and Sidney Pollack in a scene from Tootsie. I think a lot of people have wondered, how much were you playing yourself or Sidney Pollack's vision of you in that scene? And did this reflect your working relationship at all?
Yes to all those questions is the short answer. Tootsie was originated by myself and Murray Siskel, a friend of mine at the time, which is another story, where we actually asked each other one day, you know, we all know what it feels like when we say, you know, what would it be like to be the opposite sex? But we had never asked, would our personalities be different if we were the opposite sex? And that was really the beginning of Tootsie, and we went and spent 2 years writing drafts of it. The real answer to your question is, you know, a comedy is, I think, is no different than life. There's a serious underside to comedy. And every actor that I know that saw that film saw the underside, saw the contradiction of when you study your craft for years, and then when you go out and get a job, it's two different animals. The people want you to do it fast. They're not interested in you, you know, going for the details, say the lines, you know, hit your mark and get off the stage or get fired. In this scene, I'm saying, but a tomato doesn't have legs. A tomato can't move. And that's exactly what we would then try to solve in acting class. And we don't just play a tomato. It's specific. A painter doesn't just paint a tomato. It's specific. What kind is it? But in film acting, everything was kind of made more general and, in a sense, less of an art form. So actors understood it on a level that no one else did. I still maintain. I mean, yes, if you were doing that scene, I don't feel any differently. Someone would say, you know, move. You say, I can't move. I'm a tomato. Tomato doesn't have legs. And then you would find a way to roll or to do something that where you couldn't use your legs. That's acting.
Dustin Hoffman. He made his directorial debut this month with the release of the film Quartet, starring Maggie Smith. You'll find a much, much longer version of Dustin Hoffman's conversation with Terry Gross on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.